I've said before that one of my favorite podcasts of the year is the first show after the NFL draft. And boy, is that going to be true today. Not only did the Kansas City Chiefs go through an entire draft, making a lot of interesting picks that I can't wait to dig into, they also took a player that seems to fly in the face of everything they've claimed to represent over the last, however many years that Clark Hunt has been at the helm of the team. Welcome to Roughing the Kicker. I'm Joshua Briscoe. I could not be more excited to have this show today. Going to talk about the impact of every single player in this draft for the Chiefs, and then, of course, talking about Tyreek Hill, the controversy surrounding around that. So, programming note, I've decided to end this show talking about Hill, because I want to talk about the story as a whole, and I think it's become the biggest story of the Chiefs' draft, which is kind of amazing. And if you don't agree with that, you can look at Andy Reid and John Dorsey having an impromptu press conference back on Saturday. That being said, I'm going to talk about each of the draftees first, Skip Hill, and then at the 39-minute mark, because I'm recording this intro after that, 39 minutes in, we start talking about Hill, so you can plan accordingly. So the Chiefs traded back to start all of this off with the San Francisco 49ers. I thought the Chiefs were going to have to take their pick at the end of the first round. I was surprised to see that the Niners wanted to trade up. They did. The Chiefs trade back on the first night. The trade was fine. To me, in the later trade back, the Dorsey was also fine. I'll get to that a little bit later. But to me, there's a really bizarre narrative going around that Dorsey somehow, like, had fleeced the 49ers in some way, that he had pulled off some grand heist. And then that narrative really makes no sense to me. If you are arguing that, I guess I'd like to hear why you would say that. But I talked to some people on Twitter, and I think that kind of died down. But he got reasonable picks for the picks that they were trading back from. That's fine. They were fine trades, but nobody got taken advantage of. Not Dorsey, not the teams that are trading up. It seems better for the Chiefs because the team that traded up took a guard, and then the Buccaneers later took a kicker. So it makes it seem like those picks were kind of, you know, not wasted, but were sold at less than market, or more than market value, because it was for a guard and a kicker. That doesn't actually affect what the Chiefs got. Overall, the trade back was fine. I have no problem with it. It wasn't some grand heist. Now the Chiefs trading back happened after the Denver Broncos traded up and drafted Paxton Lynch, the quarterback from Memphis. Dorsey said afterwards that the Denver trading up had no role in their decision to trade back with the Niners, meaning that they were not going to take Lynch. Not worried about that. Afterwards, though, there were reports that have come out since then. I think it was Paxton Lynch's agent that said the Chiefs were interested. We don't know. We'll probably never know. Sorry about that. Vahe Gregorian tweeted that Dorsey said, quote, about two players we really kind of focused in on didn't work. So whoever those would have been, whoever those guys were, in a reasonable range, whenever they didn't show up, the Chiefs are very willing to trade back. They did. It's fine. So then we go to day two, because the Chiefs, not interesting there. I have some notes about the other teams in AFC West that I'll probably save for the next episode of the show, because there's so much Chiefs stuff here, but the Raiders and Broncos made some really interesting moves. And the Chargers got one of the best players in the draft. They got the first non-quarterback in the draft. So a lot of interesting stuff going on in the AFC West here. Day two got kicked off interestingly because Miles Jack was the sort of the surprise name, really falling because of his injury concerns. And the Jaguars traded up to hop over exactly one team to jump up to number 38, and that was the Chiefs. They moved from 38 to 36. The Chiefs picked 37th. And they moved up to take Miles Jack. So there was some discussion that maybe the Chiefs were interested in Jack. That trade makes me think that Jacksonville certainly thought the Chiefs were interested. So the Jags hopped up and took him. What did end up happening was the 37th pick in the draft. The Chiefs took Chris Jones, defensive tackle from Mississippi State. The immediate response here for me was this is an exactly prime John Dorsey move. Draft a guy high to replace a guy on his way out. This punches Dontari Poe's ticket out of town in my mind. Jones is here, and if you don't know what I'm talking about pattern-wise, John Dorsey's first pick in Kansas City was Eric Fisher, who was drafted with 1 year left in Brandon Albert's deal. Dee Ford was drafted with 1 year left in Tom Bahali's deal, and Marcus Peters was drafted with 1 year left in Sean Smith's deal. Now, Chris Jones is drafted with 1 year left in Dontari Poe's deal. This is exactly the John Dorsey move. And someone said, I think it was Mike Mayock who said, quote, if he had stayed another year, he might have been a top five pick. My first reaction, regardless of that, regardless of anything, even if Jones, if you said Chris Jones is going to be an all-pro, you could have given that guarantee. People still would have been annoyed by the fact that he seems to be a pick for next season. And at the same time, though, we said that about Marcus Peters on some level. He was the pick taken to replace Sean Smith, and he was going to, you know, he was going to step into play this year in 2016. What ended up happening, obviously, is he was the number two corner, played extremely well, defensive rookie of the year. Jones is supposed to replace Poe, but he's so versatile from what I've heard, just anywhere along the defensive line, that he will absolutely find playing time on this team as a rookie. I think he's trying to focus him in at nose tackle to take over for Poe. So they want to groom him there more than anything else, but I bet we see him play all across the defensive line. And, you know, if Poe or Jay Howard or Alan Bailey get injured, it seems like Chris Jones gives the defensive line really incredible diversity and versatility there to where he could step in any of those spots, especially for, you know, a couple of games. So with that being said, with those three guys, with Howard and Poe and Bailey and then Chris Jones being able to step in wherever he needs to, I think the Chiefs have a case to make as the best defensive line in a 3-4 defense in all of the NFL. Some praise around Twitter, rlads_Shanka said Chris Jones from Mississippi State might be the most underrated defensive tackle in this draft. Layered NFL Draft on Twitter said, love the Chris Jones pick for Kansas City. Great fit, great player, top 15 talent in this class. Pro Football Focus said he had the second highest grade of all interior defensive linemen in this draft class against Power 5 opponents in 2015. I'm going to read that again because that's super interesting to me. The second highest grade of all interior D linemen in this draft class against Power 5 opponents. Up against the best talent, he played the second best. Another thing that I think is very interesting here, whenever we talk about, and the Chiefs ended up addressing corners in a big, big way, and the linebacker, they didn't end up taking an actual linebacker except for their last pick, which is an outside pass rusher kind of guy. Think about Bob Sutton's defense. I think we all agree that Bob Sutton can do a lot of very good things with this defense. There are a lot of things that he can manufacture. If he's getting a pass rush, he can manufacture a pass rush. If he's getting a pass rush, he can really make the coverage systems look good. If he's got a good cover guys, he can make the pass rush look better. The one thing that I don't think Bob Sutton can manufacture is a talented lockdown defensive line, especially on the inside. Whenever you have those kind of guys pressuring the inside, locking down the run game there, Sutton can make things happen everywhere else. The most important unit for Bob Sutton, I think, as far as talent goes, is the defensive line. It's very, very hard, especially against a really good quarterback, to overcompensate, or just to compensate at all, I suppose, to compensate for a subpar defensive line from a talent perspective. If you don't have natural pressure there or a natural run stopper there, you're going to have to take from other very valuable units to make that work out. As you do that, if you have to play a little more aggressively with your linebackers or whatever, even a guy like Phillip Rivers, who's just been around the league long enough, is going to say, okay, they are biting here, here, and here. This gives me this gap in the passing game or here in the run game. But if Bob Sutton really trusts his defensive line, which I think he does currently and will continue to do with Jones added to this mix, the rest of the defense is going to be left to a lot of Sutton's interpretation, which I think is a good thing overall. I do have a couple of concerns with this. First of all, as he said that out of Houston, Mississippi, population 10,000, that quote, McDonald's is the biggest store in town and Hardee's is the next biggest place. I'm afraid that Kansas City Barbecue could end his career before it even begins. Second of all, I saw his 40-yard dash during the NFL Combine, and I'm just going to describe what happened. And if you'd like to see this, you can watch it. I've seen the video, and it's hilarious and a little uncomfortable. He runs the 40-yard dash, and at the end, he slides face first very oddly. It didn't look like he fell, but it looked like he slid, like he was playing baseball. And what happened is he went face first as soon as possible, because his entire manhood fell out of the front of his spandex shorts. And I don't know how else to say that, but that happened. And he's a Chief now. And frankly, I'm proud to have him as a member of the team that I'm a fan of, because it's hilarious. It's hilarious to watch one time, and you got to stop watching it because you start to wonder some things. I will absolutely not be giving out grades on this episode. Draft grades are completely useless until like 3 years after the draft, and you can actually look back and see about the production. And later in the season, I'll probably look back on some earlier drafts and kind of give quote-unquote grades for the, you know, 2013, 2012, 2011 drafts. and actually evaluate them after things happened. I also just noticed that I have 12 pages of notes in a Google document for this show. That's where the show is fun, but it's also 3:30 in the morning currently. This is a mistake. All of this is a mistake. Let me ignore my hatred for draft day draft grades and say this from Pro Football Focus. They gave this pick an A+, which is the only A+ they gave in the second round, and they only gave one A+ in the first round. Here's what they wrote about Chris Jones. Quote, Jones has immense potential, already posting the number 2 pass rush grade in the nation last year, but still showing room to improve from a technique standpoint. He's strong and explosive, and his 2-year grades on about 1,000 snaps are comparable to the best interior defensive lineman in the class. This could end up being the steal of the draft. Cool. Good with that. Happy with that so far. Let's just continue the praise. From SB Nation's Stephen White. Quote, I saw him as a 5 technique defensive end, bull rush a left tackle a couple steps, then rip off to hit the quarterback and pressure on the play. I saw him line up as a 4-3, head up on the right tackle and split a double team with a right guard to make a tackle in the backfield. I saw Jones on a 3 technique, execute a nice jab ole on the inside for a clean win. I watched him as a 1 technique nose tackle on a 3rd-and-1, jack up a left guard and then rip inside of him to tackle a running back for no gain on the 3rd-and-1. I saw him line up as a 0 nose, jack up the center and make a decent tackle on a good running back I was talking about earlier. He says, some guys can't seem to flash at one position, and here's this Jones kid all just up and down the line kicking ass and taking names. That's why you are comfortable making this your first pick, an early second round pick, whatever. Being able to do that up and down the entire defensive line is so valuable. So I've bought into Chris Jones here. At Real MN Chiefs Fan on Twitter writes, Chris Jones' ceiling is if he took the best features of Jay Howard and Alan Bailey and spliced them into one player. I'm not kidding. Now, a guy getting picked in the 30s hitting his absolute ceiling in the NFL draft is, frankly, not all that common. But saying where he likely ends up, even, it's going to be a heck of a player. So I've become quite warmed up to the idea of Chris Jones as the Chiefs' first pick in this NFL draft. Then coming up on the Chiefs, the first pick that they owned that they were going to take in the original spot, the Chiefs pick in the second round, they ended up trading back with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, who again traded up and took a kicker that cost them essentially a second and a fourth round pick, because that's what they gave up to the Chiefs. The Chiefs did end up making a second pick on instead of the second round, but didn't end up making more picks in day 2. Once again, the Chiefs get a fourth round pick there, and I'm totally happy with those trade backs, but they weren't some sort of grand heists, they were just trying to take more shots at second through fourth round talent, guys. And that makes sense. The NFL draft, at best, is a lottery of educated guesses. And giving John Dorsey more lottery tickets to take shots on guys in that range is totally fine by me. Dorsey obviously believes that this team needed more depth and that this is the place to get it. So making these moves to step back 15 spots or so to add another shot at a fourth round guy. In this case, a guy who ended up being, I don't remember who it was that ended up being taken with that Tampa Bay pick. It looks like it would have been Eric Murray, which we'll talk about in a little bit. So adding Eric Murray to the roster for the sake of moving back those 15 spots, totally, totally fine by me. So what the Chiefs end up doing with that next pick coming up there, the trade back, is with the 74th pick in the NFL draft, they took cornerback from Notre Dame, Kavare Russell. Now, this is something where, again, grades on draft day or the day after the draft are just lying to you. But later on I'll do a review of maybe a past year's draft and actually grade them there. Draft day grades are ridiculous, but Pro Football Focus has some good thoughts here. They gave him a C on this pick. Doesn't really matter to me. But here is a short little write-up from Pro Football Focus on Kavare Russell, the cornerback. Coming back from missing all of 2014 due to academics, Russell's negative 1.3 overall grade ranked 94th among cornerbacks in this class. He's too deliberate in his movements, often leading him to being a step late in coverage, but his length is an intriguing fit as a potential man coverage player in Kansas City's scheme. So there's something intriguing, but mostly negative. What I see here, and this continues on for the Chiefs in a lot of ways that I didn't know at this time, but at the time, I wrote that with Russell's flexibility, the Chiefs now have options. Gaines can move outside, or he can stay inside and let Russell, Nelson, and Parker play the slot, or let Russell go outside and let Gaines, Nelson, Parker play the slot. And a Gaines-Nelson-Parker rotation on the inside or in nickel packages is super intriguing to me. Now, on the positive side of things, Matt Miller at NFL Draft Scout on Twitter said the Chiefs got a steal in Kavari Russell. He'll start day one at outside corner, in my opinion. Now that, just want to rewind and say that again. Also, Rand Gatlin retweeted him and said, really athletic player, going to be fun to watch him play at the next level. The Chiefs got a steal, blah, blah, blah. He'll start day one at outside corner, in my opinion, from Matt Miller. If that ends up being true, the Chiefs have an incredible pick here, obviously. You find a day one starter in the top of the third round, you're pretty happy with it. This is going to, I've said for over and over, I wouldn't have franchised Eric Berry, I would have franchised Sean Smith. I've said that 1,000 times, you've heard me say that. Because even though I just talked about Bob Sutton, how he needs a defensive line, it's very hard to overcompensate, or again, just to compensate for a discrepancy at your corners. The secondary looked so good last year because Ron Parker locked down the slot, Peters locked down one side, Sean Smith locked down the other. Peters was the guy who got picked on, and he stepped up more often than not. That's why he had so many interceptions, because he got challenged all the time. Tops in the league. This is not going to happen to Marcus Peters next year to nearly that same degree, because he won't be the less experienced corner. Unless Phillip Gaines is up playing on the outside, but even then, Phillip Gaines will have less experience playing outside. Gaines played played his rookie season mostly in the slot and was injured for almost all of last season. Marcus Peters is going to be, in a way, the veteran of the cornerbacks this upcoming season, because we will see two, we may see three corners from this draft playing on getting actual minutes on this team. Plus Phil Gaines, plus Steven Nelson, who barely got on the field, and he is exclusively a slot corner. Peters is not going to get that same kind of challenge, although by good quarterbacks, they will still be, not. They won't fear Peters, I don't think. The guy who's going to get the Marcus Peters treatment this upcoming year is probably going to be Russell. And if he can step up and be a competent outside starter day one, that's an enormous burden off the Chiefs' shoulders. Todd Palmer tweeted that Russell, who's from Everett, Washington, said, the Chiefs just changed my family's circumstance. He talked a lot about his family's circumstance, to be redundant, and in his conference call and everything. That was really good. From the NFL Draft Scout, more breakdown of what he can actually do. Love what Kavari Russell can be. One of the most instinctive cornerbacks in this class. Smooth mover, physical line of scrimmage, and a hitter. That was on April 10th. That was before the pick at all. But the similarities there to Marcus Peters, I think, are very interesting. Marcus Peters, that's something that we talked about on draft day, and then we talked about throughout the season, that he proved time and time again that he seemed to have incredible instincts as a corner. And for Russell to be able to do the same thing, that could be what the Chiefs look for more than the height and size. I'll get to in a little bit. Terez Paylor pointed out something very interesting about the narrative that we've given Chiefs corners and John Dorsey, something that's just simply not true. What might be the case that gives Dorsey the, I guess the opposite of red flag, green flag, perhaps, that gives Dorsey a green flag on a corner, or really anyone in the secondary, is saying, this guy has physical tools and instincts, we can fine-tune the rest of him. Also, Russell seems like a fantastic fit here. He said, I love to play press. He said he didn't take a pre-draft visit with the Chiefs, which has also become a strange theme with Kansas City. But playing boundary corner, left corner, and limited nickel, lots of press man. With all of that in mind, I'm willing to trust Dorsey and the Chiefs defensive coaches to develop this kind of guy, especially seeing that he's been a part of this system. To me, Russell's the most interesting pick in the draft for the Chiefs. He's got the potential to be a day one starter. He loves the press. He's a physical corner. Talked about being a boundary corner. That's what the Chiefs need the most on their team overall next season, is that guy to step up. That's what the Chiefs need the most. And now get ready for me to say that again in about 3 minutes. With a pick after this next one. The next pick, though, pick 105, the pick they got for trading back with the Niners, the Chiefs in the fourth round, took Parker Anger, guard from Cincinnati. My apologies to Parker Anger for having a hard time talking about guards in this instance, but I've got a little bit of guard material. Zach Fulton, Laurent Duvernay-Tardif, Ja Reed, and Parker Anger are going to be thrown into a really good competition for two starting guard spots in training camp. Reed has swing tackle potential if Fisher or Schwartz get hurt. And they ended up releasing Paul Fanica, which was strange. And also Ben Grubbs is gone. So those guys that I listed are pretty much the guys. Also, another, by the way, reminder of how nice it is to have Mitchell Schwartz and just feel good about the tackles right now. The Chiefs ended up giving Eric Fisher, they signed him to their fifth-year option, so he's under contract for 2017 currently. I still think we see an extension, but another tackle from the Bills just got an enormous extension, which worries me a little bit. At this point, though, I think we might see the Chiefs wait until into the season a little bit to see how he's developed in the offseason, to make sure everything's playing nicely, and just because the timing works out better that way. I digress, because that rabbit trail went way out of bounds. LDT, Reed, Anger, Fulton. Those four guys are going to compete to start at guard, and then you're going to feel pretty good about that third, whichever one doesn't make that cut, because that's a nice... We saw this with Zach Fulton, and we feel good about Mitch Morse at center. But of those four guys, there's going to be two starters and like kind of a swing guy. That is a nice guard rotation, which is the first time I've been able to say that for the Chiefs in a very long time. Ja Reed also has swing tackle potential. So I think we could see basically those four guards and Schwartz and Fisher as the six linemen that make this team currently, because Reed could play either tackle spot, and I think he ends up not playing guard if I had to guess right now and just stab at it. The Chiefs seem to really like LDT, so we see Anger and LDT, which, by the way, Mike Mayock compared both of them, both as developmental guys. I expect Anger to be more polished because he went in the fourth round. That might be a mistake in my mind. But at this point, if I had to put it together, I'd say Fisher left. I don't know which side they want each player to take, but LDT and Anger as the guards, Morse at center, Schwartz at right tackle, and then Reed as your swing tackle, and then Fulton can play either guard spot or center. If they can go into the season carrying only seven offensive linemen and then a guy or two on the practice squad, that even opens up a space maybe to carry another receiver, to carry another defensive back, and it seems like they're going to want to do that. So I think the Chiefs have built a surprisingly strong offensive line here, partially thanks to the bold move to go get Mitchell Schwartz. So I feel great about that. At Top Pick Scouting, talked about Parker Anger. He said they reached the pick. He has amazing size, but doesn't play like it. That's something that I would say Andy Reid and this Chiefs offensive line squad, these coaches, should be able to fix. You take a guy's physical size, instinct, and talent. Now in the NFL, you treat him like an NFL player and coach that up. I feel fine about that. With the 106th pick in the draft from the Buccaneers, which was via the Bears, but the pick the Chiefs got from trading back in the second into the early third, pick 106, the Chiefs took cornerback Eric Murray. Super athletic, super physical, another guy that says he prefers to play the boundaries, which I am thrilled about. He's going to be competing for playing time, in my mind, in a very real way. And I'm not completely alone on that, but I don't think that's the common expectation for Murray. I think he's going to be fighting for real on-field defensive playing time, and he'll also be very valuable on special teams immediately. Ron Clements on Twitter says that Murray's an aggressive corner who gets too handsy at times. Draft Countdown on Twitter said, Chiefs fans, you got a good one in Minnesota. Cornerback Aaron Murray had an outstanding game against TCU and their NFL-quality wideouts as a senior. That is a spark in my eye. I love being able to look at these guys and see what do they do against the best competition. Chris Jones, there was some really, really good film of him against LSU that made me smile and see, this is a guy who can compete with the top competition in college. That's as close as you can get to seeing what he's going to do at the next level. I feel great about that. That makes me feel good here about Murray also. Evan Silva tweeted after this pick, and this tweet isn't even true anymore. It wasn't true a couple rounds later. The updated Chiefs cornerback depth chart: Marcus Peters, Philip Gaines, Steven Nelson, Kavari Russell, Eric Murray, Marcus Cooper. You're building, that's a very young, cheap core there, or young, cheap everything there. That's building a pretty nice roster. Again, Gaines and Nelson are slot guys in my mind. Gaines has a little bit of potential to play outside, but we haven't really seen it. We saw it a little bit before he got injured when Sean Smith was suspended last year. That's as much as we've seen of it, though. Russell is going to play outside. Murray, mostly going to play outside. If either of those guys, you should be rooting for Russell and Murray to earn outside time and hopefully Russell to start outside, because Philip Gaines, his greatest value as at the slot corner. In the fourth round of the 126th overall pick, the Kansas City Chiefs took wide receiver from Florida, DeMarcus Robinson. Super talented, 6'1", 200 pounds, troubled past. Something that is going to sound, a lot of this is going to sound really silly again in a few picks, or I guess I'll skip it and come back in several picks from now. Jeff Rosen on Twitter said, DeMarcus Robinson to the Chiefs was Bob McGinn's 10th rated wide receiver in the draft. From his report, he has admitted to 3 failed drug tests. He did that also. He said those were all freshman year. He also had some issues after his freshman year. He had issues all through college. Eric Edholm said that he flunked a lot of NFL interviews. Todd McShay said that Robinson was called a, quote, top 10 athlete in this draft by some scouts. That is a loud statement. In addition to that, Ben Almquist on Twitter, at Citadel Chief, said he's an ideal Andy Reid wide receiver. Andy Reid wide receiver. Not talking about weed yet, I'll get there. An ideal Andy Reid wide receiver. Catch the ball and make things happen, but can also surprise defensive backs with taking off downfield on deep routes. That's a good summary there from Ben. So this guy overall, this is a major athlete. He's got off-the-field issues, which we talked about, mostly drug-related, also some, like, team rule stuff. That seems like the bat signal to Andy Reid. And I think Reed and this Chiefs locker room that Reed has built on, this is stuff that I thought before the Tyreek Hill pick, which again will come up. But all of this is still true to me. I think the locker room the Chiefs have and Andy Reid will get the best out of Robinson here. The biggest fear that I have came from reports that he really struggled to pick up Florida's playbook. Andy Reid's playbook will make Florida's look like a coloring book next to a quantum physics textbook. But to that point, while I like this pick a lot, it's a good risk. I'm happy with in the fourth round, take a guy with maybe top 10, top 20 in the draft talent, with drug issues in the past. But I've been saying this for weeks, and this applies still, every bit of this applies in my mind still. No rookie, and this was true for the first receiver off the board and an undrafted free agent. I believe this equally for every receiver in this draft. No rookie wide receiver is going to come in and have a first-year impact greater than Chris Conley's second-year impact in Andy Reid's system. Okay, that applies to everybody. I don't expect anything from Robinson in the first 8 weeks of the season. If he's respectable number 3 by the playoffs and for next year, and growing next year, we should take that happily. I don't know if you could say that Andy Reid trusted Conley as a number 3 wide receiver last year, by the end of last year. And Chris Conley, one of his selling points is how smart he is. I don't think Andy Reid. What was Chris Conley last year? I'm going to go through the options in the playoffs where he was in the depth chart, or you know, as far as pass catchers, Macklin, Kelsey, West and Wilson probably. And then all of a sudden, Jason Avant was getting targets, and then Macklin got hurt, and Conley became relevant again. And that's not an indictment on Conley. And you could argue some of those points if you'd like. I think I'm going to stick with that, but that's not an indictment on Conley at all. It's an indictment on how difficult Andy Reid's system is. One of the most interesting things that I talked to Mark Boerichter about at one point last year was just how, honestly, from a receiver's standpoint, ex-chief Mark Boerichter, from a receiver's standpoint, how difficult is the West Coast offense really? What is Andy Reid's system really like? And he rattled off a play, just like a play call, and my job dropped open a little bit. Because, and I understand, if you're in that system, if you're Alex Smith, if you're Jeremy Macklin, guys who, anyone who's been in Andy Reid's offense for a while, that becomes second nature. I get it. You're speaking another language. But you wouldn't expect to drop Chris Conley into a huddle where they're speaking, like, Spanglish. Like, not totally a different language, but, like, something is different. It's like half, it's a jumble here. You wouldn't expect him to be fluent in that immediately. And I certainly don't expect that from Robinson, especially with this idea that maybe he struggled with Florida's playbook. That concerns me more than the drug issues. So now I'm holding off on Hill, but this point is important to all the things that I said about this being a good risk, about saying top 10 talent and being suspended 3 times as a freshman and then missing a game, I think is even as a senior, or in his final season, which I think was actually his junior year. I think he missed a game all 3 seasons of his college career and was suspended 3 times as a freshman for drug tests. I think that's accurate. I apologize if I flubbed that somewhere. But I say that's a good risk. And I say that's a good risk because Robinson's drug-related past here is outweighed by incredible talent. I say that because I see weed as a pretty benign, you know, quote-unquote character issue, though Josh Gordon, it's kept Josh Gordon out of the league for a long time now. But in the past, I think I see marijuana as a pretty benign issue, and I have sympathy for the language of that's been used with Robinson, the idea of struggling with addiction and going into rehab, which he did. I have sympathy for that, the way that that's put out there. I think he even said on his conference call that he hasn't smoked weed since he was suspended for it. And I don't know if I believe that. And frankly, I don't really care. I wouldn't care if it wasn't a suspension issue. Because, I mean, look at how society talks about weed now. The Laramie Tunsil thing was insane because it came out right as the draft was starting and he was smoking it out of a gas mask. Realizing that it was from his past and someone else posted it, I wouldn't have had an issue taking him, having the Ravens take him, wherever they were picking up at the top. So, I suppose if there was a sort of unapologetic brashness about a drug that got him suspended, I would probably be prickling up at this a little bit more. But again, the going into rehab and talking about a struggle with addiction, though it's a drug that is not something that we really talk about being a hardcore addiction or whatever, I have sympathy for that. And I can see that being something that is fixable within a good structure. And I think that is something that Andy Reid and the Chiefs can provide. I'm going to be speaking very differently about a quote-unquote issue, a character flaw, a few picks from now. And I understand that. So I hope that clears up the idea, the potential hypocrisy in that. But I digress for now. Looking at the wide receiver depth chart for next year, this is before Hill. We'll see what Hill ends up being able to do. The Chiefs have Conley, Streeter, Albert Wilson as 2, 3, and 4. Macklin obviously is the one. This is from DrSkrilla8 on Twitter. No guy in the fourth is probably going to be playing over any of those guys, especially in year one of Andy Reid offense. I totally agree with that. Now, Rod Streeter is the flexible guy there. I don't know if Rod Streeter in Andy Reid's offense is going to be super receptive to it also. You expect Conley to. You expect Albert Wilson to be. The Chiefs also signed free agent wide receiver Mike Williams a little bit before the draft. And actually, this is more interesting than it should be to me. You probably remember Mike Williams. He caught 11, if you play fantasy football, you do. He caught 11 touchdowns as a rookie in Tampa Bay in 2010. 11 touchdowns in Tampa Bay in 2010, and caught 60 or more passes on 120 or more targets in 2010, 2011, and 2012. He only played 12 games in the last 2 years, though. So I'm surprisingly interested in his future here, because we've seen really great flashes from Mike Williams. So to see how the Chiefs use him, I'm intrigued, even if I shouldn't be. In the fifth round, pick 162, the Chiefs took quarterback from Stanford, Kevin Hogan. With all the picks they were mounting up here, I said early on that this would be a range when they could absolutely take a developmental quarterback. I think they've done that here a little bit. At Matt Waldman on Twitter, I was told by a quarterback coach that Kevin Hogan's mind for the game was extremely impressive. If he refines the physical, look out. Well, good news, bad news here. Andy Reid can't make Hogan's arm stronger. He can't make him a better physical product, but he can definitely cater to Hogan's strengths. And taking a guy that someone tweeted that the Chiefs took Chase Hogan here. Hogan is here to be Chase Daniel for however long his contract is here. And then maybe longer because Andy Reid wants to have a consistent backup. Sam Monson on Twitter at PFF_Sam from Pro Football Focus. Said, Kevin Hogan's interesting. He was so much better in 2015 than 2014, but wasn't exactly great. Kind of intrigued by such a big jump, though. I think that is interesting, but overall, the Chiefs think they found the next Chase Daniel here. Not their next starter, at least not in my mind. To that end, though, so Hogan is coming in to be the backup. He's a fifth-round pick. Can he beat out Aaron Murray and Tyler Bray? I don't know. I don't know if he will. I mean, he will be on the roster, but he might not justify that for this season. So I'm currently actually thinking the Chiefs could sort of surprise people with their final quarterback roster. Tyler Bray was the undrafted free agent out of Tennessee. He's been on the roster for a few years now. Aaron Murray, the draft pick out of Georgia. This pick of Hogan actually makes me think that Murray might be the guy who doesn't make it here. Bray has been put on IR for different reasons the last couple of seasons. But the Chiefs gave Bray a 2-year contract last year, meaning they wanted to stay invested in him on some level, even though he was injured and not playing at all. I think of these three guys, of Hogan, Murray, and Bray, Bray certainly has the best physical tools, and with that, might have the highest ceiling out of any of these three guys. What I think this is with Hogan, I think this is an indictment on Aaron Murray's development, because these two, Murray and Hogan, are very similar, and for me, from the way I look at how I would like to develop quarterbacks if I was a coach or a GM, You want to have your starter, in this case Alex Smith. You want to have your solid backup, was Chase Daniel. Now in this case, could be Kevin Hogan, could be Aaron Murray. And then you want to have your developmental third guy. The guy that you say, we can change this developmental guy every year if we want. But we're going to keep taking shots at building up this guy to eventually take over the team. And that will certainly not always work, because usually those guys have to come earlier in the draft. But if you're taking guys from the back end a little bit and really working on building them to eventually be a starter or maybe even a backup someday, but with the potential to be a starter, that's who I want my third quarterback to be. I don't know what good it does to have Aaron Murray be your third quarterback again. He was a third quarterback behind Chase Daniel because they were kind of grooming him to be Chase Daniel. At this point, do you make Murray Chase Daniel and you make Hogan the next Chase Daniel? I don't like that. I don't like that strategy of building up quarterbacks. If the Chiefs think more highly of Hogan and that they think eventually he can run Andy Reid's offense as a starter as well as Alex Smith, from what I've heard, he might have a better chance of doing that than Aaron Murray does. And then, again, if you think Hogan could carry the clipboard as the second guy this year, I would have no problem at all having the quarterback roster go Smith, Hogan, Bray, or Smith, Bray, Hogan, depending on where Bray's development is. The next pick was Tyreek Hill. I'm holding off on that for another 5 minutes. Now, in round six, pick number 178, the Chiefs took cornerback, again, DJ Wyatt out of Georgia Tech. Pro Football Focus, Sam, PFF underscore Sam on Twitter, said, DJ Wyatt, nice pick for the Chiefs. Now the Chiefs have taken five corners in the last two drafts. Marcus Peters, Kavari Russell, Eric Murray, Steven Nelson, DJ White. But obviously John Dorsey knew the Chiefs came into this with a cornerback issue. Not only at the top for the side opposite Marcus Peters, but also for depth. Jamel Fleming has moved to safety, and the safety position has really weakened. Eric Berry is on a one-year franchise tag deal currently. Ron Parker, great. Jamel Fleming, developmental. Tyvon Branch, gone. Hussein Abdullah, retired. A lot of shifting going on back there. Seemed like DJ White might have some potential to be stepping back to safety some as well. But with all of that, especially with Fleming moving back, don't have any faith in Marcus Cooper, the Chiefs kind of need to rebuild a lot of even the depth of their secondary. Doing that with a lot of rookies and second-year guys concerns me. In fact, the only guy that I didn't list there that was on that depth chart earlier that matters is Philip Gaines, and he's a third-year guy. So Philip Gaines being the veteran of that group as a third-year player is kind of nuts, especially with the idea that Gaines might be the slot corner. You could have a third-year guy at your slot, second-year guy Marcus Peters at one side, and a rookie Kavari Russell on the other side, with your depth being rookie Eric Murray, second-year player Steven Nelson, rookie DJ White. Woo! Putting a lot of faith in your pass rush, I guess, because that's a risk. And if that hits, that's why you have to have some position go cheaply. And cheap and young is vital in the NFL in at least one position group. We've talked about that over and over and over. Part of the reason the Chiefs took Chris Jones, so they don't have to pay Dontari Poe, they can afford to spend money elsewhere. I wouldn't have done that at corner. I would have paid for a veteran corner for a few years that you could really believe in, opposite Marcus Peters. Chiefs decided this was where to do it. This was one of the places to do it, because they've spent a lot of money at linebacker. Derek Johnson, Tom Bahali, Justin Houston. Big money at linebacker. Defensive line, sizable money for Alan Bailey and Jay Howard. Money on the way for Dontari Poe they might be able to avoid now because they draft Jones. A lot of money in that defense. A lot of money in the secondary and in the safeties. Ron Parker, nice deal. Eric Berry, huge number this year. The Chiefs are paying everywhere on defense except for the corners. They've invested in the corners. That's what they're going with draft picks. But it's a gamble. Last pick, round six, pick 203. Daddy Nicholas, defensive end from Virginia Tech. Adam Teicher had a nice write-up. Said Nicholas is about 235 pounds, so he's far too light to play defensive end, and he'll even have to add some weight to become an effective outside linebacker. He has some skills as a pass rusher, but it's a stretch to think the Chiefs will benefit from those skills anytime soon. He looks like he's a practice squad candidate at best as a rookie. So, Adam Teicher never one to let the optimism get to him, which is good in this case. Round six, we don't need to be investing in this person as the future of the franchise. Maybe we get some pass rushing depth, though, for a team that will need it, especially while Justin Houston is still out. Okay, now for the fun part. In the fifth round of the NFL draft, with pick 165, the Chiefs took someone originally listed as a running back, which was surprising to me. Then I realized it was probably for a slot receiver, kind of kick punt returner kind of guy. and I was right there. That's about the only thing here that I saw coming. It was Tyreek Hill, wide receiver from West Alabama, previously with Oklahoma State. Hill has some incredible return ability. Chief Scout Ryan Nutt said that special teams coach Dave Taub gave Hill comparisons to Devin Hester. Really great physical tools. Hill pleaded guilty last year to punching and strangling his pregnant girlfriend. Got 3 years of probation and was kicked off the team at Oklahoma State and transferred to West Alabama. But really, again, just incredible athlete. Really great speed. Let's focus on the football, right? This is bothersome to the credit of Chiefs fans, to most Chiefs fans, or most Chiefs fans are bothered by this, which is I'm happy about. So I guess we're going to just call that a character flaw, perhaps. And Clark Hunt and Andy Reid love talking about character guys, especially Clark Hunt, about character and how important character is to this team. Here's a description of some of the things that Hill not was accused of, not allegedly, but led to an actual felony domestic abuse plea agreement. Hill, quote, threw my laptop and my phone into the hallway before ordering, unquote, before ordering her to leave his apartment, Espinel testified. She said that she was not in the hallway outside of Hill's room, Hill's girlfriend, with the Hill's pregnant girlfriend, but did not leave because she was wearing only a t-shirt and underwear. After she re-entered the apartment, quote, domestic violence occurred, she said. In response to questions from Payne County District Attorney Lynn Hermanson, Espinel said that Hill, quote, punched my face. When I tried to get up, I was put into a chokehold for longer than a minute. Espinel, who at the time the alleged attack told police investigators she was pregnant with Hill's child, said Hill punched her stomach on the left side and after that grabbed my neck and started choking me again. He was pounding my head against the wall. I'm not sure how you decide that person's worth having on your team. You could say that spending a fifth-round pick on a kick-return, punt-return guy is questionable on its own. Without, I don't know, having the guy have a felony charge of beating and strangling his pregnant girlfriend, something that he's admitted to readily. And then on the conference call, after he was picked, where the Chiefs thoroughly controlled what he was asked, on the conference call, he apologized for embarrassing the coaches in the Oklahoma State program, instead of apologizing for beating his pregnant girlfriend. He said that what he learned from that is he needs to choose his friends better. I don't know what that means, but it's a deflection of his own responsibility in what actually happened, which is really a hideous thing to say you're due. I don't want him to apologize to Oklahoma State. I want him to apologize for beating his pregnant girlfriend. I'm not going to say that he should be forever disallowed from holding a job or even a job in the NFL, but the Chiefs shouldn't have been the one to give him that opportunity. Why did they? Because he can return kicks and punts really, really well. And if you think that's a reason enough to do it, then that's, you can say that. I will not argue that that's worth that trade-off, at least not in the context of everything that Clark Hunt, just that drum he's constantly banging about character guys, about why Eric Berry and Derek Johnson are so valuable. It's not a simple math equation where you just have to have more, you know, quote, good guys than bad guys. There's not math to it. The Chiefs could have brought in Greg Hardy and had this same reaction, probably worse because we have pictures, definitely worse because we have pictures from that. And I don't get it. I don't get it. Dorsey said, the Chiefs had, if you don't believe that this is the biggest story of the Chiefs draft and worth every minute that I'm going to give to it and every minute the media has given to it, John Dorsey will back you up on that, because John Dorsey and Andy Reid had planned to not talk to the media after the conclusion of the draft and talk to them on Monday instead so they could work on undrafted free agents and all that. And after this pick, the outroar was so great that they met with media immediately following the draft. In that, Dorsey said that he feels that Hill will be a good representative of the community in Kansas City. I personally, genuinely, truly, deeply hope that he's right. I hope that people who do terrible things redeem themselves. But I'm not foolish enough to expect that in every case. And Andy Reid, I mentioned earlier, he has a good history of working with troubled people and troubled players, and that might even have roots in Andy Reid's personal life with his son. But this is different. This isn't marijuana. This isn't an addiction issue. This is a felony domestic abuse. Getting a felony domestic abuse charge is pretty hard. Those are usually misdemeanors. And the NFL is constantly touting the need for not tolerating domestic abuse. This might be domestic abuse and concussions are probably the two things that blare the loudest on the NFL's radar of issues with the league. And you could also argue how they handled discipline and Roger Goodell's power structure. That's a very nuanced NFL fan thing to have worry about. The high profile things are concussions and domestic abuse. And this is, it's not about distractions. It's not, this is just the posturing of it all is so frustrating to me. I mean, thank goodness that Tyreek Hill wasn't smoking weed out of a gas mask, because that would have been a disaster. Or someone in some comment section, somebody said, thank God he wasn't gay like Michael Sam is, because that would have been a distraction. And Michael Sam dropped in the draft, and is now no longer on a team with other issues that go beyond, I mean, touch on his actual play and where he wants to be as far as his career. I get all of that, but initially, into the draft, the talk was, well, Michael Sam being the first openly gay player to be drafted, that would be a distraction. And no, it's about production. So like it or not, with Tyreek Hill and with the Chiefs now, it's about production. Dorsey came out swinging to protect and defend the selection. And boy, there was a couple of things. I'll go to their transcript here in a second. But like it or not, now it's about production. Hill has to be clean off the field, and he has to, but maybe more importantly, he has to play well. If the Chiefs win a Super Bowl and he has a nice season, his abuse is not going to show up on the podium. If he does anything like this again, or if he fumbles in a spotlight, then it's going to be full-blown rage. Why do they draft this abuser? Why did they enable this trend? You're gonna hear that if he fumbles a kickoff in the playoffs. If he returns that kick for a touchdown, you're gonna hear nothing but, look at the power of second chances. Look at Dorsey and Reed believing in this guy. Look at what that brought to the team and to him as a person. You don't know that. And I hope it bothers people, because it bothers me, because it's at this point, it's simply true that Hill's redemption story is going to go exactly as far as his kickoff returns. And that's bothersome to me. And if you disagree with that, please, I'm on Twitter, at JB Briscoe. Longer messages can go to the Ref and the Kicker Facebook page, facebook.com/RTK show. Is your mindset on Hill going to change on anything other than his play? Because I think if we look at it long enough, I think we can understand that's going to be the main issue. Now, if there's another assault, then full-blown rage, justifiably. Currently, just having him on the team, ton of pushback, justifiably. But if he plays poorly, there will be full-blown rage. The fans will throw this back in the faces of Reed and Dorsey and say, how could you give this guy a chance? And they'll say that if he fumbles it in a playoff game. If he takes it back to the house opening day, night one, in prime time, in a playoff game, in a divisional game, in Denver, on a punt or a kickoff, we're going to go, look at this guy. Look at the value the Chiefs found there. Look at what Reed and Dorsey made. Look at what they dug for. Look at how Dave Taub is using this total weapon. What an organization. And that drives me insane. And I'm going to do it too. And I think we're all going to do it. We're all going to say we're going to give this guy as much leash as his play earns him. And that's how the NFL works. That's why Greg Hardy got on the roster last year, because why Ray Rice didn't. Ray Rice dragging his unconscious girlfriend out of an elevator, or fiance out of an elevator. By the way, there's video to that. If Tyreek Hill had video, he would not be on the Chiefs. If there's video of this thing happening, he would not be on a roster. Maybe some team would give him an undrafted free agent visit. Maybe. He would not have gotten picked. There is no chance. Zero. If there's video of this. Video of Ray Rice. Video plus Ray Rice not being good anymore means, oh, we're all going to take a strong moral stance here. Greg Hardy. Pictures. High profile incident. But a talented player? All right, Cowboys, you give him a shot. Tyreek Hill pleaded guilty. 3 years probation. Looking at jail time if that happens again. If anything, if he violates his probation in any way, he can face up to 3 years in jail. By the way, just the math on that seems like a bad logistical decision by the Chiefs. You slip up, your player is gone for 3 years, because logistics seem to matter the most here, but whatever. I would encourage anyone to go to the Chiefs.com and watch the press conference from John Dorsey and Andy Reid, or listen to it or whatever, after the draft, because they say some incredible things. But I'm going to play a few things of sound here. The first one I want to play is, there's a question from Herbie Teope. He says, how much interaction did you have with Clark Hunt before making this selection? And then Dorsey has, this is Dorsey's response. Listen to what he does here. When he throws it, he kind of talks himself into a corner, throws it to Reed, and then Andy Reid wastes no time totally shifting the onus back over on the John Dorsey and saying, well, really, that's a question for John.
Well, I mean, we sat down and had long discussions about this. At the end of the day, as we vetted this process through, we all felt that, you know, it was good. I mean, Coach Reed, you may want to address that as well, too, in terms of how detailed we went into that, because you and I had some long conversations as well.
Yeah, so, Herbie, I would tell you that, and listen, I'm a little bit, I'm a coach. Dorse does the personnel stuff. He's done his homework here. So, and there has to be a certain trust here. There's just things that we can't go into, and go through. And we want people to understand that, like Doris said, we're not going to do anything to put this community or this organization in a bind. And we've uncovered every possible stone that we possibly could, we feel very comfortable with that part of it. So
right, I have to stop it there, because that's halfway through what Andy Reid touches on throughout that clip. Like, that's half of his quote. Dorsey answers the question, kind of tries to a little bit, then says, Coach Reed, you might want to address this as well in terms of how detailed he went into that, because I know you had some long conversations as well. Reed says, yeah, so, Herbie, I would tell you that, and listen, I'm a coach. Dorsey does the personnel stuff. He's done his homework there. No one, unsurprisingly, you shouldn't be surprised by this, nobody wants to take responsibility for actually making this pick. No one wants to actually take responsibility for doing the homework, which is bizarre. Like, I get it. No one should want to take responsibility for it, because people are mad. And if it backfires, people are going to be mad at them. But someone needs to be like, yeah, you know what? I signed off on that. I was fine with that pick. I actually did talk to people. And they talk over and over about how they turned over every possible stone, but then wouldn't go into any specifics, wouldn't say if they talked to the actual assault victim or not. Reed said that Hill's been in counseling. Todd Palmer from The Star asked, what did he specifically say or do that convinces you that he really has changed and the community isn't in harm? Dorsey immediately answers that by saying, we've done our due diligences, we really have. Then he says, I have young children, I have a girl, I have a boy. I would hope that someone in my seat did as much work as I did. But they refuse to, and they talk about trust all the time. They both ask for trust. Trust in the system, I guess. Trust in their own, I don't know what, just trust. Trust in their vetting process. And boy, they love to say vetting process. I'm disappointed in this. I'm disappointed even in the way, that Hill's conference call went. I'm disappointed in the way that Dorsey and Reed talked about it. They were given every opportunity and every question to give a chance to say either, listen, we get the fear here, and here's what we did to say this is worth it. Here's what we did. And they spoke in vague terms. TJ Carpenter asked, you know, you feel like he will be a good representative of the team? Dorsey, I do. Trez Paylor says, you've talked about bringing character guys into the team. Dorsey says, let me play you what Dorsey said.
John, you guys talk a lot about character, good football, you know, strong character. But on the other hand, you know, this is a major thing. This is a serious thing that he's been accused of doing, that he's pled to. And then there's other people, you know.
Trez, this is how I feel. I know, listen to me. Okay, this is not about touchdowns. This is not about football. I understand this is about people and lives and communities. I understand that. And that's why I just want you all and you to realize one thing. We have done a lot of research within this thing. And that's where I'm coming from is the man and the person. Okay, that's where I'm coming from.
It's not about touchdowns and football? I don't know how you can say that with a straight face. Of course it is. I mean, and on some level, like, he shouldn't be fighting that. That's obviously what it's about. It's about touchdowns in football. It's about people. This situation, maybe he means, this situation involves people. And people are concerned and upset and disappointed in the organization. Those people? I don't think I understand that. And then it doesn't really get a whole lot better throughout this press conference. By the way, God bless BJ Kissel from Chiefs.com asking questions about cornerbacks. And boy, John Dorsey was stoked to answer that question. I mean, it's just smackdown, smackdown, smackdown on poor choice of words. About Hill the whole way through this. And then BJ Kissel said, coming into the draft, was cornerback an area that you felt like you were going to come in and take multiple guys? And Dorsey gives him a strong two paragraphs of answer about the cornerbacks, which we'll talk more about cornerbacks later. I'm going to talk about Hill for the rest of the show. And then Trez Paylor bops back in talking about the community and concern. So nice try, BJ. I respect your job. All right, let's go to the next thing. This is a long bit of sound. It's probably the last one I play from this. But this is Todd Palmer's question from the Star about what did he specifically say or do. You'll hear that. And then Dorsey's answer, which to me sounds just aimless and with no details and with nothing but personal anecdotes and a plea for trust. And then Reed also goes on with personal anecdotes and pleads for trust. And he says something towards the very end that the first time I heard it, I don't know how to describe what I did. I actually, like, jolted back in my chair because it is a heck of a way to talk about what actually happened here.
John, what specifically did he say or do that makes you... Because this was only 16 months ago, and it was a very ugly incident, if you wrote a police report and stuff.
Correct.
What did he say or do that convinced you that he really has changed and that the community isn't in danger?
Well, we have done all of our due diligence. I mean, we really have. And I will say this right off the bat. You know, I have young children here. I have young children. I have a girl and I have a boy. But I would hope that if somebody in my seat did as much work as I could, I'd be happy with that. Because I know that I would never I would never put this community in any type of situation where I knew it would not be good. And we've done that. I would like to ask you guys to have a little bit of trust in us in this thing.
One thing I can add into that, John, and I'm not sure who's asking the question. I'm sorry, I can't see. But
it's Todd. It's Todd, Coach.
Todd, okay, so my wife and I have been hugely involved in domestic violence. So, it's been an awesome, awesome venture for the last 14 years. So the unique part of this, and I think the part that we have to understand is very seldom does the other side try to right the wrong, you know, however you want to divide it, try to right the wrong. And so much effort, I mean, from the Hope House to, you know, these different, the different programs in the city here that are involved with this strive to try to get that other half to better themselves. So, I see this. That's where we see this kid trying to do that. I mean, he's trying to make this effort to right the wrong, and that's a. I think that can be a great example to so many people that are falling into this situation. And again, I've seen a number of these cases. You have to trust me over time here.
Fallen into this situation. is a phrase that blows my mind a little bit. And I'm not trying to beat up Andy Reid on it too terribly, because he was blabbering on, and that happens when you blabber. I'm sure I've said plenty of blabbery things that made no sense doing this show. I've probably done it today several times. But I think that can be a great example to so many people that have fallen into this situation. And I guess he's talking about, in the case of domestic abuse, the abuser, the person trying to right the wrong, which he says a lot. And there's a lot of pleas for trust, and a lot of talk about righting the wrong. There are so many situations that people can fall into. Maybe they don't have a strong, maybe a young man doesn't grow up with a strong male positive influence in their life. People fall into, are born into poor socioeconomic standings. People are born into circumstances. People fall into circumstances all the time. That impact, that's why we all have such different perspectives on things. If we all were born in the exact same circumstances, we would have a much more similar world. Okay. Everybody gets that, right? I think that was not profound. That was I'm hoping you're listening to this saying, yeah, duh, dummy. Because, yeah, that's super obvious. There are different situations that people fall into. I've never heard of anyone falling into getting angry enough at your pregnant girlfriend that you hit her and look at it from the court document, the words strangle her and punching her in the face and stomach, bashing her head on the wall. You don't fall into that. At some point, you have to take responsibility for your own actions. And the idea that Hill went on the conference call and said he needs to choose his friends better, and that Andy Reid and John Dorsey said, we vetted, you gotta trust us. We went through a vetting process, man. We vetted so much, there was so much vetting here. People fall into situations all the time. There is so much, we did our due diligence, just have a little trust in us. What does that mean? What are you actually asking for? And people, some of the reporters in this interview, in this press conference said, well, did you talk to the victim? What? Tell us about your vetting process. Well, there are some things we just really can't really talk about. No, yes, you can! Talk about them! The legal issues aren't so fast that you can't say who you talked to when you were trying to figure out if you wanted to draft this player and bring this player into your NFL franchise, onto your team, into your community. And for the most part, especially John Dorsey doesn't say anything. John Dorsey never says anything, and that's fine. He doesn't owe. I fancy myself a little bit of a journalist and a little bit of a reporter. I have no credentials. Right now, I'm a blabbermouth. But throughout life, a little bit of a journalist. I hope to do that in the future. Fancy myself a little bit of the media. He doesn't owe the media much of anything. He doesn't owe the fans much of anything. I mean, the media feeds the fans, and the fans feed the corporation financially. That's how that system works. I get that. That there's the fans, and the actual organization, and the media is the middle of that. So you owe enough to keep your fans interested just because you want your business to stay financially viable. The NFL is so far beyond that point that John Dorsey, as a person, doesn't really owe the media or the fans really jack. In this case, I think you do. If you don't owe the media and fans, and mostly the fans and the community, if you don't owe them just a little bit of a walkthrough of what you did through this vetting process, if you don't owe them that, you should be willingly wanting to give that. Because your fans right now are turning. They're not turning into Broncos fans, not turning into Raiders fans, not even turning away from the NFL. But the way they look at this organization, the way I look at this organization, the way I look at Clark Hunt and John Dorsey and Andy Reid, is tinted by this pick. And even more than that, potentially, tinted by the way they have handled it. Let me learn about your process here. Convince me that I should trust you. When Dorsey and Reid said, man, I would just love to ask you for some trust, just a little bit of trust in this thing. No. Why should I trust you? Why should we take your word for the fact, the idea, that you went through every possible channel on this? Why should we take that at face value? You wouldn't. You absolutely would not. In fact, based on your vetting process, you obviously didn't, if you did go through that much of a vetting process. Did you go to Tyreek Hill and say, hey, man, what happened? Like, listen, you guys, I really would just like it if you would just trust me here. If you just have a little trust in me in this thing, I think I've earned it. Then Dorsey went, oh, sure, okay, all right, we'll take you. Fifth round or so. We'll be there. Of course not. There's an issue that they saw. They say they went through a lot of different, I'm going to keep saying vetting as much as they did. So many different vetting processes to find and turn over every stone here. But they don't expect the fans or the media, which again, journalists, that's like their entire job is to do this. They don't expect fans and the media to want the same from them. For the media to turn over every stone now, trying to figure out what exactly the Chiefs did through this process with Hill? My gripe with Tyreek Hill as a person is pretty clear cut, right? Don't do that to anyone. Not just your girlfriend, your pregnant girlfriend. Don't hit and strangle people. Don't do that. Michael Vick, don't kill dogs. Don't strangle dogs. Don't drown dogs. Greg Hardy, do not beat your girlfriend and throw her on a bed covered in automatic weapons. Don't do those things. No. Just don't do that. The difference here is Michael Vick spent 2 years in jail, and then Andy Reid said, all right, let's try this again. And Michael Vick became a bit of an activist on some level, I think you could argue, to combat what he did with the dogfighting and everything. Greg Hardy missed a bunch of NFL games, but he is now at the point of not even admitting that he did the thing. Tyreek Hill had a crap conference call, and now John Dorsey and Andy Reid are standing up for the process that they went through. Ray Rice, even, as a person, I think made a lot of reasonably correct steps after that video came out. Not perfect, but reasonable. That's not happening. It didn't happen with Greg Hardy. It's not happening here right now. If the Chiefs and Tyreek Hill want to take some very Band-Aid approaches to things, now the wound is there. If they want to take the Band-Aid to the wound and have him speak out on some level about domestic abuse and his situation specifically, then again, it's a Band-Aid. Fine, put that Band-Aid on. I'm all in favor of that Band-Aid. But you can't undo this pick. There are people calling for him to be released immediately. That was never going to happen. Maybe you had the idea that Clark Hunt would call John Dorsey and say, no, we are not doing this. We're not signing him. You wasted a pick. Let it go. No. Either in this case, Clark Hunt just gives the reins to John Dorsey and Andy Reid, or in all likelihood, and it sounds like they talked to Clark about this before the pick, Hunt knew it was an option. He's a chief now. Tyreek Hill is a chief. If you really don't like that, you turn your TV off, I guess. I won't do that because I'm talking about the team and I want to watch football. And it's amazing that I can honestly say that. And it bothers me about myself a little. And if you think, I don't know, I know this segment's gone on a long time because I just have, there's so much, and also kind of gone more slowly than previous segments, because usually this show, I think, is kind of frenetic, and I'm kind of frenetic, and it's blasting through highlights and plays and players and discussions and topics and debates and things. And I think this discussion demands a little more slowness because there's so much, and so much to me that is a little bit just beyond my grasp, a little bit baffling, and I take issue a little bit. This is a very Dan Le Batard thing to do, so if you don't like Dan Le Batard, I'm sorry. He talks about how people moralizing about marijuana is super frustrating to him, because we as a culture and as a country even, there are states when recreational marijuana is totally legal. States, a lot of states, where medical marijuana is legal. States where you can't sell, but you can possess. I mean, and overall, the way we look at marijuana as a society is changing so much, and it's changed so quickly. Look at, like, what Ricky Williams, the backlash to him, and compared to now. So the idea of moralizing on weed is something that is super bothersome to Le Batard, and something that annoys me a little bit. It's why I'm not horrifically concerned about that as far as Robinson, the pick of Robinson, the receiver from Florida. I have no problem moralizing about felony domestic abuse, any domestic abuse, this specific case, other specific cases, other more general cases. I have no problem doing that, and I'm hoping that you don't have a problem with that either. Now it's a question of, well, what happens from here? And the only thing we can do is watch. Because as I said earlier, this redemption story, this success story, if it is one, for the Chiefs, for Hill, for fans, the rehabilitation story will all travel just as far as his returns do. This is going to ultimately hinge on Tyreek Hill's football ability. And this is something where it'll be a deal in training camp. Once the regular season starts, there's too much stuff happens in the NFL season. And John Dorsey and Andrew know this. We're not going to be talking about this in the season unless he does something to justify it, either good, bad, or ugly. This is going to be an off-season story, and they're going to get grilled about it. And if he plays well, the story's going to go away, just like they planned. That bothers me. There's a lot of other stuff to talk about from the AFC West with the Chargers, the Raiders, the Broncos that all happen in this draft that I will have months to talk about, and I will do that. This show's already over an hour, so I'm going to wrap this one up here. This is Roughing the Kicker on Arrowhead Addict Radio. I'm your host, Joshua Briscoe. It kind of bums me out that I'm guessing most people aren't still listening right now. But if you are, I appreciate it because I think we're at one of the most important topics the Chiefs have come across in a while. Especially, I didn't even mention how the connection this organization had with Javon Belcher. And yeah, that's it. I want to say thank you to the Patreon supporters of this show, people who give a little bit of money to make this show free and sustainable. $20 group, Don Beal at DonBeal32, Andy Simpson, Steven Smith, Derek Vaughn at D_Vaughn88. $10 group, longtime supporters, Christine Roadlander at C Roadlander, and Ty Declare at TyDeclare44. Also thanks to Josh Beadle, Ben Rahman, and Jason Essler. You guys help, like I said, keep this show running. If you want to support this show financially, you can do that at patreon.com/RTK. You can get in touch with the show at JB Briscoe on Twitter, facebook.com/RTK show. You can give this show reviews on iTunes and tell people that you like it. That apparently really helps. I don't know how. Make sure you do subscribe to the show on iTunes, though, especially as this off-season schedule is sort of taking form. I'm wrapping up my school schedule. First of all, apologies also for getting this being this late after the draft to get this show out. Finals and podcasts collide, but that's going to wrap up here soon. So with a pretty fluid schedule looking forward for the offseason, subscribe on iTunes, never miss another episode. Always get them delivered straight to your mobile device or your computer. Thanks again for listening. There's a lot on this show. I hope you learned a lot for the breakdown of the players and what I think and what we should think about these players going forward. And I hope we can all discuss the Tyreek Hill issue, what the Chiefs should do, what the Chiefs have done so far, what they'll do going forward. I hope we can all talk about that. I think it's important. As always, thank you for listening. I'm Joshua Briscoe. Bye, Mom. Excuse me, sir, but could you drop the bass?